Hey everyone, you're listening to On Their Behalf, formerly known as DNA, a True Crime Podcast. Please enjoy.
Ooh, I have a good one for you.
Okay.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Would you rather give up all drinks except for water or give up anything that was cooked in an oven?
Give up everything cooked in an oven.
You can't give up wine.
Absolutely not. Actually, you know what?
I thought you would, like, maybe think a little bit.
No, absolutely not. Look, I'll actually show you. I'll turn it around. I just got back from the grocery store.
Oh, yes. We started doing the boxed wines, and it's just much more convenient.
Yeah, this wine that I get is, I think I brought it to your house once. It's the Bogle Cab. It's a red. It's like inexpensive. It's only $7.99 at Trader Joe's. Obviously, if you get it from anywhere else, it's more expensive. But, right. And it's like
brought to you by Bogle Cabin.
Yeah.
Hit us up for sponsorship.
Yeah. Promo code DNA. yeah.
Just kidding. We're poor.
Yeah, we're not there yet. One day we will be. yeah. It's really good. It's a good wine. But I don't think. I mean, that's why I can't commit a crime, because then I'd have to go to jail.
Raw, no pasta, no bread.
Wait, like, no pizza. Cooked in the oven at all? Like, can I use the stove's top?
Oh, I guess you could say yes.
I could deal with that.
Yeah. All right.
I think so.
Well, that was something.
Who knows? Hey, and welcome back to DNA, a True Crime Podcast.
I'm Devin the D.
And I'm Asia the A.
And this is our podcast.
This is our podcast. And guess what? Devin is going to tell me a story.
Oh, yeah.
This week. And so far, she's only given me very, like, giddy faces. And, like, I can't wait to tell you this story because it's so crazy. So I'm excited.
Well, I'm a little nervous because this is definitely, like, a left turn from what we have been doing. But I was, like, after the last two-parter, I was feeling, like, very heavy, down. And like you said with the Freeway Phantom story in episode 3, I believe. Go check it out. This was just calling to me. So I'm going to tell a wacky story that I really like that I knew about before. Like, I knew about the story, which is why I was like, I want to revisit it. But I just think it's kind of fun. So, and you'll see that, like, I'm not being flippant.
Okay.
Like, it's fun.
Okay. All right.
So, I don't know.
Oh, God, tell me.
Okay. Have you heard of Agatha Christie?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Because literally everyone in the world has heard of her. She's the most prolific mystery writer of all time.
Yes.
Did you know that she disappeared?
No.
Yeah. So, this week I'm going to tell you about the mysterious disappearance of Agatha Christie. So everybody knows about Agatha Christie, but I'm going to dive in. She was one of my favorite writers growing up, actually. I feel like her, though she is like murder mysteries, like, of course, little baby Devin was like super into like all the different ways someone could be murdered and how to find out who did it. And I actually had like a computer game of And Then There Were None, and you could like play through the story.
Oh, yeah.
And people were, like, dropping, like, flies. And I loved it. And I was, like, super, super into her stories. But I haven't read her stuff in a while.
Me either. But I did start listening to, you know, the podcast Criminal, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Phoebe Judge is reading a chapter a day of Agatha Christie during this time.
Oh, that's good.
Because, like, she's home doing nothing, so she just records herself and reads a mystery, a chapter of a mystery every day. And she started with Agatha Christie. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure what this, like, second book is, but she just reads a chapter a day and uploads it. It's called Phoebe Reads a Mystery.
That's so much fun.
And I've been listening to it before I go to bed.
That's delightful.
Yeah, you should totally. Yeah, it's so great. And her voice is so soothing and calming that, like, even when she's telling you about, like, the most gruesome thing ever, you still kind of feel
relaxed. Well, that's also what I love about Agatha Christie's writing is that there's such humor in it, even when you're talking about very dark stuff, but she sort of like mastered that kind of like titillation that you get in like reading this kind of stuff. And none of her stories are real, obviously, so you can feel more like funky about it, you know. But her writing did help establish the way that we tell mysteries today, and even the way that like you and I are doing this. You know, telling a true crime podcast, it's like we can't ignore how influential she has been. She's been published over 101 times and has written over 69 novels.
Wow.
That's crazy. And like short stories, all these kinds of things. She has two super popular characters with their series, which is Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot, who is like that like detective guy. She is the most sold author in the English language, tied literally only with Shakespeare. Like, are you kidding? That's crazy. And her sales are like on the low end, 2 billion, and on the high end, 4 billion.
Oh, okay.
And for like a little bit of like context, J.K. Rowling has sold 500 million. So. She just far and away.
So what you're saying is Agatha Christie is just an overachiever.
Just a huge overachiever.
And she's just killing it.
In her sleep, everything. But it wasn't always like that. So this is part of her journey and like how it took her to get started really like resonated with me in this time. So that was part of the reason that I really wanted to tell this story. Agatha Christie was born Agatha Mary Clarissa Miller on September 15th, 1890 in Torquay, Devon, England. So another reason I wanted to tell, like, she's a girl from Devon and she's Virgo like me. So love her already. She was the...
if you didn't already love her a lot.
She was the youngest of three siblings. She was educated at home because her mom was a little bit kooky. But her mom was like an English lady of wealth and her dad was an American guy. So she came kind of from like two different backgrounds. Her mother encouraged her to write as a kid and she always loved fantasy and creating characters. And that was something that she always like really liked to do. Her autobiography was published posthumously. I don't know if I'm saying that word right, but after she died, somebody published her autobiography.
Posthumously?
That sounds better than what I said.
There you go.
She says...
I don't know if I'm right either. I could be
wrong. Let us know. How do you say that word? From her autobiography, she says, "One of the luckiest things that can happen to you in life is to have a happy childhood. I had a very happy childhood. I had a home and a garden that I loved, a wise and patient nanny. As father and mother, two people who loved each other dearly and made a success of their marriage and of parenthood." So, charmed life.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, really beautiful. Also, thematic to what we talk about in other things, which is like stopping the cycle of abuse happens when you treat your kids nicely and teach them nicely. So, just be nice to your kids and a lot of the problems in the world will go away. I truly believe that.
And if your kids, you know, are acting up, it's you know, it's okay. Yeah. It's a cycle.
And you
know?
Say why. You know, just... And you get to the why instead of you just don't hit them. Just don't hit them.
Yeah. Just, don't be abusive. Yeah. In any relationship, your kids, your spouses, friends.
Agatha Christie knew that. So you should know it too. At 16, so she was educated at home. She's a homeschooled kid, so probably a little bit weird. Love you, my homeschool kids, but let's be real. Yeah. At 16, she moved to Paris to study singing and piano. Oh, can you imagine?
That sounds divine.
I know, right? Just like gallivanting around Paris.
Around Paris, singing, just to like
playing the piano. Yeah. And it's like
drinking
what,
wine. Oh, wait, no, she's 16. Oh. I was going to say eating bread, cheese, and wine because that's like my ideal.
It's a dream come
vacation.
True. You know, I want to do Europe, the piano, Italy. And I would give up everything to go study singing and piano in Paris. But while she was there, she realized that her voice wasn't that good. So
she didn't know that before she left.
And she started writing short stories.
Okay.
And she sent them out. She went to several publishers and was rejected by all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody liked her writing.
Yep.
And this is where I feel like I felt very connected with her because she is like living her best life. She's in Paris. She's like trying a bunch of things and then just is getting like rejection, 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 rejection. And then, of course, World War One hits. And everything literally blows up in her face. So, like...
Like, literally.
Literally. She had to put everything on hold. Stop, drop, roll. Like, put all her dreams aside. Because of World War One. And what are you going to do? Yeah. You have no choice. Mm-hmm. Anything. A little bit before World War One in 1912, she went to a party. And she met a dashing young colonel named Archibald Christie. And
Archibald
Christie, right?
Okay.
Got it. Down with it. Mm-hmm. He was a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps. And they met in 1912 and they had, you know, a lovely little liaison. On August 4th, 1914, England entered into World War One. So they're English. So he was sent away. They ended up getting married on December 24th in 1914 on Christmas Eve. She was 24 and it was a little bit sped up, even though they had known each other for 2 years, but it was a little bit of sped up because of World War One. He was going off and... You know, when you're in sort of a national crisis like that, the trappings of things fall away and, like, it's the core of what's left. And it feels very romantic, even though it sounds terrible. Like, I don't want to be messing with that in my life. But I do understand that mentality because, like, right now, like, literally everything has fallen away in the world that we know it. And so I totally understand that, like, you know, rush to just like solidify the things that you hold near and dear because you need some sense of stability. You want like that connection. You want that like real thing. Yeah. So they got married. So right after they were married, Colonel Christie was deployed to France and Agatha went home to Torquay, Devon. And they had their kind of retrofitted the city hall and like the town gathering area to be a hospital to treat wounded soldiers. And Agatha volunteered to become a nurse and, you know, treat the soldiers. So she studied, she learned all about being a nurse, and she did it all as a volunteer. She also started studying pharmacy or pharmaceuticals and drugs, which they called, in England, they call it dispensing. So I was doing my research and I was like, what the fuck is dispensing? Like, what does that mean? And then I was like, well, she was a writer, so was it dispensing information? Like, I literally, like, they were, like, talking about how she was studying it and somebody was like, hey, you're really good at this. Like, come dispense in my office or whatever. And I thought she was, like, doing Morse code or something. It means being a pharmacist.
Yeah.
So, but she started studying about drugs and painkillers. Her first lesson in it was how to make arsenic.
I know.
And so this is where she, like, gathered all of this information. And she was, like, a very big journaler. And mm-hmm. they have collections of her journals. And one of them from this time period is all chemical equations. And wow. in her first big, or I guess her first novel that was published, the sort of like how the murder happened, mm-hmm. Hercule Poirot actually gives the chemical equation of the poison used. And like, that is the key of how he figures out who done it.
Yeah.
And it's like oh, that wow. level of detail and everything is based in her scientific background.
Yeah.
Which is she nuts.
Actually knew. That's yeah. crazy.
I know.
Good for her.
I know, ugh. Right? Like so badass. Yeah. And so she was learning about pharmacy. She took a test and like scored like average and they're like, you'll do, come on. And then, but she was also assisting in surgery. So
what?
I actually got to listen to an interview with her talk about that time so you could hear her voice and everything. It was very cool. She said she assisted in surgery in the cleanup and she said, mm-hmm. quote, in like a very like posh old lady voice, mm-hmm. you see, I'm not going to do it. Never mind. Don't.
But I'm totally keeping that in that you tried.
She said, you see, if there had been an amputation and they had things left out, the legs or the arms, anything that had been removed, I used to go down there and sometimes clean up the floor, wash all the blood that came from it, leave it clean, and then stick it in the furnace myself. There are so oh. many odd things you have to do in the hospital that you hadn't thought of. See her like chucking arms and legs into the fire. Yeah. No big deal.
Oh my gosh, that's so crazy.
I know.
I don't know if I could do that job.
I don't think so. But I don't think that she imagined she could do it until she had to do it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're made of tougher stuff than you think you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, if she hadn't become a nurse, she never would have gotten to this level of fame yeah. and, you know, prolific writing that she did because mm-hmm. she used that and she used that yeah. experience in everything. And it made her kind of not take bullshit from anybody either mm-hmm. in a really yeah. great way. And she called this the most rewarding work that she ever did. She said, quote, I think it's very satisfactory work, nursing. I felt it was from the beginning because somehow what you're doing, you feel if you're going to succeed at all, the person will be cured. So many things you're doing, you don't have that result. And oh, man, I felt that hard because a lot of like when I was trying to like figure out what I wanted to do and I was like,
yeah,
having a lot of fun working in retail or like event planning and all this stuff, it was like, yeah, it was fun, but it was like, I'm not doing anything that's contributing. I'm not helping anybody. Like, I'm not yeah. saving anybody's lives. And she's literally saying that it's like nursing is the most important work you can do. So, hey, shout out to all the nurses that are proving that true right now.
Oh, gosh. I like literally, I want to like find that quote. We should post that quote
yeah,
of her saying that.
I'll post
that.
It. That's a good idea.
Oh, gosh. That's beautiful and so inspiring for what's happening right now. Seriously.
I know. So there was like a lot of like her foundation and everything felt very similar to what we're going through right now. So mm-hmm. the more I like read into this, the more I was like, okay, I want to yeah. tell this story. And I want to tell it from our perspective because that was the way that the story is told. There's a lot of like kind of like wishy-washiness or like weird mm-hmm. politeness that I'm like, we'll crack mm-hmm. through that. So World War One ended November 11th, 1918, and 9 months later, Agatha and Archie had their first and only child, Rosalind, in August 1919. Wow. So they did not waste any time.
1919?
Yeah, it was like literally the war ended, and then like her birthday wow. is literally 9 months after.
So
I counted.
She got knocked up that night.
Yep. So, you know, they, after the war, they like moved to Berkshire, England, which is just outside of London, like, east of London or no, sorry, west of London.
Okay.
But not in the city, very much like a country area. Mm-hmm. At that time anyway, I don't know what it's like now. And in 1920, she published her first book called The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, which was about the poisoning of a rich heiress and introduce her most famous character, the Belgian detective Hercule Poirot, that I've been saying like it's not a phlegm thing caught in my throat. That's his name.
Okay.
And this is funny because apparently she only wrote the novel after she lost a bet with her sister Madge. And I don't know what the bet was or anything, yeah, but she lost, so she had to write a novel, which reminded me of the way that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. Also, let me just say, I have an English degree, English literature degree, so like this stuff is like all right up my alley.
Yeah.
Like, I love all this stuff. But Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein to like enter a ghost storytelling contest with her friends. So it was like very much like that. But it also hit me where I was like, girl, were you not going to write a book until your sister forced you to?
Yeah.
Ladies, don't ask for permission. Just do it. Just
like
go.
She lost. It just feels like a very weird thing. And also,
which makes me feel like she'd been wanting to do it and talking about it. And her sister,
and
was
her
like,
sister
all
was just
right,
like,
then.
Yeah, like it was her sister that was like, listen, yeah, she's not going to do this unless
right,
someone's
going
to force
off
her to do it. Exactly. So yeah, she's like, yes, I'm going to make this outrageous. I bet you it was just like something so stupid. Like the bet itself was like, she was definitely going to lose.
I can jump further
regardless
than you. If not, go write this book.
Yeah. I bet you I could jump higher than you or something stupid.
So silly. I wish I couldn't find out what the details of that were, but dang. But so she wrote the book and it was rejected by 6 publishers. Mm. So the 7th time was the charm. So again, don't give up, peeps. Mm. And the book was like moderately successful, that the genre of the, you know, very sort of twisty-turny detective novel was popularized by the Sherlock Holmes stories and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So it was like a genre that people wanted and were looking for, and it like it did okay, but it wasn't like anything crazy.
Yeah.
And then a few more years passed, and in 1926, Agatha made her big breakthrough when she published her 6th publication, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. And this was the publication that, like, became a bestseller and made her a famous writer. And it was the sixth time she was published. So, again, like, don't give up. You know,
yeah,
she
like,
kept
just
pushing.
Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. And for a bit of perspective, she was 36 at this time, and she had started writing 20 years prior. So, like, she was married, she had a kid, she survived, like, 4 different career pivots, including, like, a huge international war.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, I can do anything.
I know. Now I feel so much more inspired and, like, okay with the situation that we're all in.
I know. I'm so inspired by her career and just her, like, stick-to-itiveness and everything. And, like, I do want to point out, she came from, like, a well-off family. Mm-hmm. She, you know, her husband was secure in his money and everything. He had a good job. She was definitely, like, a society person. So, different
and
world.
Like, food and like milk and bread back then was like 13 cents.
So. Right. So like, you know, she had big security blankets that allowed her to keep doing this. However, it wasn't like she was 19 and the most prolific person already. Like she really still worked for it, which I really loved. So 1926 was like the year she exploded in fame and like literally became a celebrity. There was articles about her. People started recognizing her. Still, you know, 1926. So like the blurry photographs and everything, you don't always know. She didn't like to pose for portraits. So it was like people would recognize her name more than her face. Okay. And herein lies the dramatic irony.
Okay.
Because the same year that she hit it big with that book, she disappeared.
Dun, dun, dun.
I love this.
How? Like,
so
I just feel like I've never heard this before.
It's I know, right? So Friday, December 3rd, 1926, about 3 weeks before her 12th wedding anniversary, Agatha Christie vanished from her home in Berkshire, England. According to sources, around 9:30 p.m., sources meaning like household staff and the nanny.
Oh, okay.
Around 9:30 p.m., Agatha went upstairs to tuck in her 7-year-old daughter, Rosalind, kiss her goodnight, and then she got into her car and drove away. And nobody saw her again. And it was pandemonium. So the next day,
like she didn't again, return. Like ever again.
Well, let me be.
Okay, sorry. All
right. So the next day, when she didn't return, they called the police. And she was famous, obviously. So her disappearance sparked one of the largest manhunts ever mounted, like still to this day. And they immediately dispatched 1,000 policemen and put hundreds of civilians in combing the areas, looking for through the brush, looking for everything. And it was the first time that a manhunt ever used airplanes. So they took airplanes out and looked over the countryside to look for her or anything. And after the first 2 days, which everybody's seen the first 48 hours, you know they're the most important. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Didn't find anything.
Not like her car. They couldn't find her car.
Not in the first 2 days. So she's missing 2 days, and there's like literally vanished. The only thing is like people knew she drove off. So they're like, she must have gotten in an accident. She must have, you know.
Did she tell the nanny or the staff where she was going?
Just left. No. So with the mounting pressure from the public and the media frenzy, obviously this was like huge news, because what else is happening in 1926 in England? Mm-hmm. Nothing. No, I don't know. Probably a lot.
Probably a lot going on there.
Yeah. This is like one of my favorite parts. With all this like pressure, and it's
been also, I'm so happy about how excited you are right now. I've never seen you. You've been smiling ear to ear since you started this whole thing. I'm so excited.
So with all the mounting pressure and the police, and the media, the police called in two experts that they were like, maybe they can help us get into the way that she thinks, and like they maybe, you know, can help us kind of crack the case. So they called in a mystery writer named Dorothy L. Sayers, who wrote the Lord Peter Wimsey series. And they called in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle himself. Literally, what? They called Sherlock Holmes.
Oh my God.
And they're like, what sort of cockfoolery is this?
That's crazy. I love that.
It's kind of a good idea because, you know, Doyle like established this genre and was like, you know, could find anything. And if they were trying to figure out where she's going, then like people that like think the way that she did, you know, wouldn't that help? So they called them in and they were like, you know, I imagine they're using the magnifying glasses with like the corncob pipe and whatever.
Yeah.
But then on the third day, police found her car, and it was located about 16 miles from her house. So, like further than it sounds now. You know what I mean? Like, because it's 1926, like the cars don't drive as fast. It would be about a 30-minute drive now, but would probably have taken like 45 minutes, an hour, you know.
Yeah.
Then without cars going as fast. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true. That's what I read online.
I don't know either, but like I can't really gauge how long anything takes now that I've lived in Los Angeles for 5 years, because...
Right, because 16 miles would take 2 hours here.
Yeah, it's taken me an hour to get 5 miles before, so... Right.
So it was like a substantial distance, but like not too substantial that you're like, what is she doing there? Yeah. It was found...
And where did they find... Oh.
The car was found... You little detective brain.
Sorry.
The car was found abandoned on a steep slope at Newlands Corner near Guildford. So it was like direct shot, like a straight shot south of Berkshire where she lived. And I like mapped it all out on Google Maps to like figure out how far it was and everything, because there wasn't actually, I couldn't find like the detail of where it was in relation to anything. So I had to kind of like, use history and Google Maps to figure this out. So these are my calculations. Okay. But Agatha was nowhere to be found. But the weird thing about the car was that it was like kind of in the bushes, and it was hard to tell if it was like had been driven off the road or parked there. but the headlights were left on, and Agatha's suitcase and coat were in the back seat.
So she packed a bag?
So she packed a bag. But then she left the bag. And the car... So it was like, it was because it was kind of concealed is why it took them so long to find it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't look like it was intentionally concealed. So they were like thinking maybe she had driven off the road and hit something and not bumped her head and wandered off.
Yeah. And like, maybe and how many days after is this that this she disappeared?
3 days after.
3 days.
So she's been missing for 3 days. And this is in December. So it's cold.
Cold. Yeah.
And when they found the car, the tabloids went crazy.
I'm sure.
And they were just publishing, and publishing a lot of, like, theories, which I guess is why it's, like, tabloids and not newspapers, although the newspapers were covering it, but it's, like, you know, everybody's just giving all their theories. One of the most popular was that where the car was abandoned, there was this natural spring known as Silent Pool. And the local legend had it that the spring had no bottom. And I think like a year or two previously, two young children had drowned there. So the tabloids and everything were like, well, she went to kill herself there. And she went to drown herself. Her mother had just died in November. So they were, and they questioned like her mental stability since she read a lot of murder stuff. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, she can't be a sane woman. She must be hysterical.
Oh,
But there was no evidence of any of that. Nobody found in the pool. And her success had just skyrocketed. So the police were like, there's actually like no reason for her to kill herself. Like, yes, it's sad, but people lose their parents. Like, that's not... so the police didn't really feel like that.
It's not something you can't come back from. And I don't feel like from what we already know about her, that is not, I just don't think that that's something that tears her down to the point where she's like, I can't return from this. Yeah. So I need to end my life and traumatize my daughter for the rest of her life. You know, I don't think she has that type of head on her shoulders, but who knows?
Yeah. And the police didn't think it either. So they didn't, they like looked into it a little bit, but like didn't really.
Yeah.
We're like, we're going to keep looking. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, other people said that Archibald Christie killed her and got rid of the body. But that also seemed to spark no police didn't even look into that. And then there was a group of people saying
it's never the husband.
It's never. No, it's always a stranger and someone you don't know.
Yeah.
That's a lie. That's wrong. It's always the husband. And then there was a group of people. What?
That was sarcasm. That
Yeah. Yeah. Well, 90% sarcasm. if it wasn't the boyfriend, it was the husband.
Yeah, true.
If it wasn't the husband, it was the boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then there was a group of people that said it was just a publicity stunt to drive up her book sales, which
I feel like I would believe buy her that. Books. Yeah. I think that, wow. Oh my gosh. I feel like if that's true, that's badass.
I know.
Because she's already a mystery writer.
I know. It's a good idea. Like,
it's such a good idea.
Twisted, like, it's something that, like, Kris Jenner would do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know? Well, to, like, get attention on her kids.
Yeah.
If one of her kids was a mystery writer, she would absolutely do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's terrible to say.
It is, but it's true.
Okay, and then this is, like, one of my favorite... I feel like everything in the story is my favorite, but this is one of my favorite parts. So they kept looking, no sign of her, and on, like, the seventh day, they finally were like, she's been missing for a week. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence of her being dead. Like, yes, this feels like one of her books and everything, but, like, it's very weird and very strange. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle poking around, and they were like, let's use him. But he was a weirdo. And I don't know. Are you familiar with Sherlock Holmes books at all? So, you know, it's all based on logic, and it always seems like there's something magical or paranormal going on in those stories. But then Sherlock Holmes always like explains it away with science.
Yeah.
But Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually believed in, like, the magic and the paranormal. So he was actually really into spirits and all this stuff, which is funny because it's like his all his books, like, disprove everything about that, but he actually believed in it.
Okay.
So, of course, he called his bestie seance guy, medium, and they held a seance. I'm going to do that again because I gave that away.
Okay.
So he actually believed in all the paranormal stuff. So even though all of his books and his stories was basically disproving that and going the logical scientific route, you know, Doyle actually believed in spirits and everything. So, of course, he calls his best medium pal, who's like a famous medium, couldn't find the name, but apparently famous, and grabbed a pair of Agatha's gloves that she had and held a seance to try to find her spirit. And lead,
oh, no.
So her spirit could lead her them to her body.
To her body. Okay.
Didn't work.
Okay. I was gonna say, did it work?
No. Did not work. So then they were like, okay, Arthur, thanks.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I just
we'll
feel
call
like.
You. Don't call us. We'll call you.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I feel like when you said Sherlock Holmes was a, like, a part of it, or the, you know, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is going to be one of those great things.
No.
Like,
no. It was just like the most bumbling, silly thing. And I just imagine how embarrassed he must have been.
Yeah.
It's like, the whole thing with Sherlock Holmes is that, like, everybody hires him, even though he's, like, eccentric because he gets the job done.
Yeah.
And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is eccentric and also does not get the job done.
Yeah, yeah. I thought this was going to be, like, like one of the best crossover type
things. Oh, no. Real hard fail.
Damn.
Real hard fail. Hilarious.
I had a lot of faith in him. God.
No. This is just, like, the best.
Yeah.
But they continued, the media continued to publish stuff and asking, you know, everybody for tips and everything. But they just kind of like hit a wall and they couldn't find anything. It was like she just vanished. So, you know, it was good stories for newspapers and they kept saying like, it was Archibald. He killed her. He killed her.
Yeah.
And finally, on December 14th, 11 days after she disappeared, the police got a tip, and it was the head waiter from an upscale resort called the Swan Hydro in Harrogate that he had, there was something suspicious about one of the guests there. And they were like, okay, what? Because Harrogate is 250 miles from where her car was found, north.
Okay.
So they're like, how the fuck?
How did she,
did she get there? Because she would have had to take a train or taken a ride or something up there. And
but then, like, why would she leave her bag?
All of her stuff was there. So it was like, there, like, she would have had, like, no way to get there. And then to get from where she left her car, presumably around 10 p.m., and then to get to the train station itself would have been like an hour and a half walk from where she left the car. So it's like, it just seems like, what? Yeah. But they're like, it's our only lead. So we have to go up
with
there.
It.
So the police and Archibald go up north to this hotel. And the police, and they're trying to be like calm about it because they're like, we don't know if it's her. We don't know if it's a person that has something to do with it. But, like, we got to check it out. We have to, like, play it low-key. So the police are, like, going, like, very secretly going through the records with, like, the check-in books, the sign-in books with the hotel people.
Yeah.
Nobody named Agatha Christie, of course, because people know her name. And meanwhile, Archie sits in the cafe with, like, two policemen because the waiter's like, okay, the person that I'm talking about comes in like every day at 4 and like gets a coffee. So like, why don't, before we like make a big to do of it, like sit here and I'll like take her to her usual table and you tell me. And so they like sit there and Archie's like has his hat down low and his jacket up whatever. And with plainclothes police. And then the head waiter enters, like ushers in this like South African woman and sits down and she pulls out a big newspaper with, like, the headline, Agatha Christie missing, and a huge photo of herself. And she, like, does, the, like, the shakeout with the newspaper and is reading it. And then, like, kind of, like, her back is to them, puts down the newspaper and, like, looks around. And it's Agatha. It's her.
Oh, my God.
Been doing a South African accent, reading stories about herself, like waiting for someone to notice.
Oh my gosh.
And so then Archie goes up to her and is like, what are you doing?
Oh my gosh. That is great.
And then there's a quote from a witness who like was there as he was like,
yeah.
And the witness says, quote, there was a general air of puzzlement and little recognition for the man to whom she had been married. So she like was just like, oh, it's you? Mm.
Oh my God. Like, oh damn, you found me. What?
It's like the funniest thing. And he was like, go get your things. You know, go. What are you doing? How could you do this to me? Like, as all the things you can imagine, you know.
And did she's like, have like
I'm
a
gonna drink my coffee.
And so did she have like yelling just a temporary?
She's like ignoring it. What?
Like, did she have like a temporary like?
Literally, but then he was like, "We're leaving," and she was like, "I have dinner plans." So then she makes him wait as she like goes up and dresses for a nice dinner, and then goes and has dinner with like the other guests because she'd been living in the hotel for 10 days and like, you know, in the night in 1926 they had like dances and cocktails and they had cocktails. I think they could drink in the UK. But she had been like doing a South African accent and made friends there, so she was like, well, if I'm gonna leave, I might as well say goodbye.
Oh my gosh, then that's so
they realized
insane.
That she had checked in under a different name, so then and the police were like, we don't know who it would be. And so then Archibald looked in as Agatha was getting ready for dinner, looked at the names and saw that she had checked in under the name Mrs. Teresa Neal, who was Archie's 25-year-old mistress.
Oh!
So then the police were like, okay.
What? Yeah. Uh-huh.
So what actually happened the night she disappeared was that Archie came to her and said, I'm leaving you. I want a divorce. I'm going to go marry my 25-year-old mistress. Oh, who was also his secretary.
Oh, God.
And he's I'm leaving for the weekend. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was like, I'm going to go say goodnight to my daughter. Uh-huh. And she went up and said goodnight.
And then she peaced out.
Booked it. Yeah. And then it was like, well, of course.
Yeah.
Of course she fucking ran away.
Wow. And then,
I know.
And then so for him shitty. To come up to her and be like, what are you doing? Like, I can't believe you did this to me. And she's like, I'm going to finish my coffee and go to my dinner.
Yeah.
Have you're going to wait for me now.
Done?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Right?
This is the best story ever.
I know, right? I'm like, yes, bitch, get it done.
Yeah.
But the thing is that she said that she had no memory of what happened from the night before he told her, like December 3rd, before he said he wanted a divorce, until the moment she saw him in the cafe. She was like, I have no idea what happened. I have no memory of it. And I'm not talking to anybody about it. And it was like, That's when, like, the articles and everything are going, like, we'll never know what really happened. And she only mentioned it in one interview for the rest of her life. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I think we do know what happened. And I think she just didn't want to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
And
she has that right.
She totally has that right. I do wonder, though, if, like, the amnesia, because people are like, oh, she was in a fugue state because she was so upset about this. Which, like, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. Because her mom did just die and now her husband is leaving her, like, you know, that is terrible. But I wonder if she claimed amnesia not to, like, spare Archie or to, like, maintain privacy, but to not to get out of any trouble she would have been in for using police resources like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because she definitely, I mean, I guess we don't know if it was definite, but in my opinion, she planted the car and she planted the coat and the suitcase and, like,
so that
tried
they would
to
think...
use misdirection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the car was found in the opposite direction of the way that she actually went. She basically went as north as possible while still, like, having, like, an upscale place to stay in. And she, like, took a little vacation, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. But, like, it's also, like, that thing of, like, okay, so if this happened now and it wasn't a white woman doing that, oh, there would be hell to pay. But you do see, actually, cases of, like, wives disappearing and then coming back and being like, oh no, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Like that happened actually like in Utah recently or something. And it's just kind of like people are kind of stuck in like, we don't really know what to do. So my theory is that she just like wanted to punish him and like faked this disappearance. Yeah. Maybe wanted him to think that she died and killed herself. Mm-hmm. And then just like went off gallivanting to treat herself because fuck this guy. And then
and how many years were they married?
They were married for 12 years. But the crazy thing, crazier thing, is that after they went home, they stayed married for 2 more years.
Wow.
And then she divorced him. So I'm like, I love whatever's going on here. Like, she is just, like, wiping the floor with this guy.
Yeah.
Because screw him.
Yeah, she should definitely divorce him. But I wonder if the reason that they stayed together was for their daughter.
Well, they eventually got divorced, so I don't know.
Yeah, like maybe like he was kind of like, look, this is me being like, maybe, you know.
Yeah, good but twin. He was the one that initially wanted the divorce that caused her to run. So I don't know why he wouldn't. Unless he was like, I've come to my senses, and since I
like dead, this, I love you. This like maybe snapped him into like being so like full of grief and all this stuff of possibly losing her.
Yeah,
that
she
made
never
and maybe
talked about it. She like gave so many interviews and like went on and published 80,000 more books.
Yeah,
and talked about it once. She didn't even talk
That's
about.
Why I've never heard about it.
Yeah.
I just had no idea that this even was a thing with her.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's like the fact that she checked in under his girlfriend's name, I'm like, it's so obvious.
Yeah. So
because
obvious.
Like, yes, I would do that. I would just like want to get revenge in any way that I can, and that's a great way to do it where you're wasting police resources, yes, but you're not actually like hurting yourself or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1930, she remarried an archaeologist named Sir Max Mallowan, and they traveled all over the world together and, you know, studied in Egypt and Turkey and everything, which became a huge influence in her writing, like Murder on the Nile and Murder on the Orient Express. The Orient Express leaves from Istanbul. And fun fact, the movie and book Gone Girl was inspired by this whole thing.
Really?
Yeah, she invented Gone Girling.
Oh.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm trying to look up what book Phoebe reads that's of Agatha Christie's. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, The Mysterious Affair of Styles.
Oh, that's her first book.
Yeah, that's the season one, and then I don't know what season two was.
Nice.
Cool.
That's awesome. I've never read that one.
I'm going to, like, now I want to continue to listen to it because I only listened to the first couple of chapters and then I was like, I think I fell asleep and just, like, didn't continue it. But now I'm like, I want to know more. I want to know. Like, ugh.
I mean, she's so talented. She eventually died in 1976, so 50 years after her disappearance and 100 publications later. I know. I do want to say one thing about her work and sort of what she represents, because she is a cultured white British lady from England, as British people are from there, and she married an archaeologist and they lived a lot in North Africa and the Middle East, and sort of represents this very romanticized era of like British colonialism, which is I find icky. And it's, you know, that same sort of like Indiana Jones kind of like vibe. And it's problematic. And you see that in her writing. Like, you know, she has a book called Murder on the Orient Express. And my favorite book of hers, it's like a standalone book called And Then There Were None. It's like kind of like central mystery is based off this old poem or folklore that has a racist title that in American books now says now is called 10 Little Indians, but it was 10 Little N-Words. I do want to make sure that we acknowledge that part of it and acknowledge that, like, just like in Sherlock Holmes, just like in Mark Twain, like, integral to this writing is a lot of this bias and racism. And it's not like it's, you know, KKK propaganda or anything, but it is there and it is important to recognize what she has done and how prolific and how, you know, fun her writing is and interesting and all the good things that she's brought to it, but also all the bad things.
And acknowledging that, like, she, because of the time, because of what was okay back then, even though it wasn't, and now, like, you can acknowledge both the good things that she did and also the not so great parts, the unhelpful of her
things
as well
that she contributed to society. I do also want to say I am not a fan of the product of their time argument because it's literally only applied to white people because, you know, the people that were kidnapped from Africa and forced into slavery are not products of their time, you know?
True.
Like they knew it was wrong. So other people had the capacity to know it was wrong. So that's not my favorite argument. However, like, people are products of their time and environment. So, you know, it's a little push and pull. I do still love her. I love her writing. I think she's, like, a really fun character, crazy talented. But she's kind of, like... I love her
even more now. Now, after knowing this.
Right? And it's, like, it's okay to love her. I think, you know, I don't actually believe that you can, like, separate art from the artist, but I also don't think that you have to, like... totally cancel everything. I think everything is nuanced, everything is more than one thing, and if you just have to acknowledge all of it, understand it, and then be able to move forward.
Agreed.
So I'm gonna end this very fun, very weird episode that's totally out of left field and not at all what we usually do.
No,
but I needed something joyful.
It was definitely a story we needed after the last two episodes because they were really hard to get
a little
through.
Bit about revenge.
And I think this was great. And I didn't know this story at all, and I'm still completely shocked.
And it's still true crime. We're not. You know, there are more crimes than murders. So she's super quotable, obviously, because she has so many books. But I'm going to read three quotes from her that I think speak to sort of like what we do in the podcast and everything. The first one, which I think very beautifully applies to this situation, she says, quote, "It's like all those quiet people, when they do lose their tempers, they lose them with vengeance." And I'm like, yes. She just like low simmered and then like Gone Girl'd it. And then also, which I think, one that I think is a good application for this, she says, "But surely for everything you love, you have to pay some price." Which kind of goes to, you know, was successful. She had made it in her own right. And then her husband, like, pulls the rug out from under her and takes away the home life and everything she's built. In a really shitty way. So it feels that like that kind of like push and pull that you can't. And it speaks to the myth. It's a myth and it's not true that women can't have it all. Women only can't have it all because men like Archie pull shit like that.
Yeah.
And the final quote that I think will speak to you and me and what we do, she says, quote, "The truth, however ugly in itself, is always curious and beautiful to seekers after it."
Oh, that's beautiful.
And that made me think of us.
Yeah.
And I loved that one. So this episode is dedicated to our crime queen, Agatha Christie, to powerful women who are blamed and punished for their men's insecurities, and to those of us who can learn from the good and the bad the past has to offer and charge into the future fighting for equality, love, and understanding.
This episode was written by Devin Balsamo Gillis
and edited by Asia Hamilton,
with music by Holly Amber Church.
Photos and sources can be found on our Instagram at @DNA_podcast.
Please download, subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. You can find DNA, a true crime podcast, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
See you next time.